Sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Today, Frank Tolupko joins me on the show. He's doing some fascinating research on an aspect of 9/11, which we'll share with you today. Frank has had a radio show on 9/11 in the Berkshires in Great Barrington for roughly 10 years. It airs on WBCR. He's currently on a hiatus and will start his show again in September. He's been researching 9/11 since very early on. We met at a 9/11 conference in Keene, New Hampshire, somewhere around 2008, and have since then created with a larger group the website Journalists and Other Media Professionals for 9/11 Truth, and have put on many local 9/11 events together. And Frank was instrumental in putting on the 12th anniversary 9/11 conference in Washington, D.C. this past September. He's very knowledgeable about the evolution of the 9/11 truth movement and the mountains of evidence it has compiled. It's a pleasure to have him on the show today. Frank Tolupko, welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
Yeah, so you and I have both been studying 9/11 for many years now, and we've both presented a lot of the physical evidence that contradicts the official account of 9/11 on our radio shows, which, of course, the corporate media won't look at, which also points to a cover-up, which we've also explored on our shows. So there's evidence of a government and media cover-up of the evidence. There's another indication that 9/11 wasn't what we've been told, and that's foreknowledge, the evidence of foreknowledge.
Exactly.
Yeah, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about some of the foreknowledge that you're aware of.
I think one of the most important ones is the put and call options, that people were betting that the airline stocks of the two airlines that were involved in 9/11, I think it was United and American, were going to plummet after 9/11. Therefore, there was a lot of activity, and it's been shown to be statistically significant, way, way significant, that a lot of put options were put, that the stock was going to fall and people could make money on that. And that would indicate to a certain level, to certain people, foreknowledge. Subsequent to that, they also did further studies on call options. That means you're betting that a price of a stock is going to rise in the future. So therefore, you put a call option in. And they found out that there were very significant call options on a lot of the technology stocks, armament stocks, etc. before that. So again, that's no proof of anything other than the fact that it's very strange and it's part of a whole gestalt of everything else that went on. That's one example.
Right, and the put options meant that the price of stock would go down.
Yes, it would go down.
Yeah, and so those were on the
airlines. Those airlines were going to lose money because their planes had crashed. They'd have to put in new equipment for screening passengers, et cetera, and their profit line would be affected. Mm-hmm. So somebody knew about that. In fact, some of the put options, people have not collected the money they made from them. They've gone dormant, so to speak. I guess got a little too hot out there.
Yeah, and couldn't the Security Exchange Commission reveal who those people are?
Very interestingly, they can find out, as we know now, they can find out within 24 to 36 hours of all that stuff. But they took a number of years to come out with a statement that was included in the 9/11 Commission report, which is very interesting. It was just a one paragraph, a couple of statements saying, we've investigated the so-called put options, and we find that no terrorist had benefited from the events of September 11th. Notice the wording, no terrorist had benefited. They didn't say no one benefited. They said no terrorist had benefited. Sort of like they couldn't be accused of lying, but yet they didn't want to reveal anything.
Didn't I read somewhere that they said that there was that the Securities and Exchange now lost all the records on this?
Well, the Securities and Exchange Commission was an occupant of the World Trade Center 7 building, that third building that had come down. The building that was to the north of the two towers. And yes, there supposedly was a lot of material for the Enron case, etc., that had been destroyed. I don't know how significant that is in the sense of, I would imagine they had more than paper. They may have had it on various electronic media, but who knows? Mm-hmm. It certainly would have slowed down the investigation, that's for sure, before they could put everything together. Right. I mean, there are other examples, obviously, of foreknowledge that people were trading on their computers. There were a lot of financial companies within the, stock firms within the World Trade Center. And that morning, there was a vast amount of transfer of money from public accounts, so to speak, to private accounts The reasoning being is that they felt that those computers were going to be destroyed, and therefore nobody could really trace where the money was. But they did recover some of the hard drives. They sent them to Germany, and they were able to recover a lot of information. The only problem is that the company in Germany said that they're under strict gag rule from the United States government to not reveal who those people were. So there isn't information out there. Obviously, the fact of the mere existence of those hard drives and the trading, they do admit the trading went on, but they won't reveal who, is another indication of foreknowledge that something was going to happen.
Right, right. And can you give us another example of foreknowledge of the events of 9/11?
Another indication of foreknowledge is the famous iconic shot of Flight 11 going into the North Tower, the first building that was hit, the North Tower. That has been played over and over again, and supposedly it was shot accidentally by two filmmakers that were doing a documentary on a probationary fire officer within the fire department of New York, and they just happened to be at the right spot at the right time to get it.
Yeah, tell us more about that. Who were they? Give us a little background on that.
Two brothers, the Norday brothers, Jules and Gideon, were supposedly, I say supposedly because there's no real record of them and their education, where they were born in France. They have no record of them. They claim that they were born in Paris. There's no record of them there. They claim they went to a film school at NYU. NYU doesn't have any record of them being there. They had made some small film back in the late 1990s. They were permitted by the Fire Department of New York to film the progress of a probationary fireman starting in January or February of that year. And so they were around the Duane Street Fire Department that was on Duane Street. And they were going out that morning to film the investigation of a gas leak to the north of the World Trade Center, probably about 10 or 15 blocks to the north of there. When all of a sudden, at 9:45 that morning, they heard a plane go by and they looked up, swiveled their camera around, and got a perfectly centered shot of the plane going into the building. There's no other place that they could have gotten such a shot without foreknowledge. There's been a lot of investigation, though not as much publicized within the 911 Truth community or anywhere else, about this particular documentary film. The film that they made that day was not just of the plane going in, but the destruction of the towers, of the other plane coming in, and all the chaos that ensued in Lower Manhattan that day. They won a number of awards for a documentary. They have not done too much since then.
And prior to that, had they done much?
Well, they had, as I had indicated, they had done one small film about a boxer, an amateur boxer in East Harlem, probably to establish their bona fides as filmmakers or whatever, but that didn't really go too far. So, again, the circumstances of their being at the right spot at the right time are very, very, very questionable. I can go into particular details of that. I guess everybody should have in mind that iconic first shot as I talk about it. The raw film that they shot that day had been purloined or grabbed by NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, that was doing an investigation they're part of the Commerce Department. But the government tasked them with finding out why the buildings fell, how the buildings fell, including Building 7. They had held on to the raw film footage for years. The Norday brothers kept a copy of the original, were able to put together the documentary and clean it up, as the case may be. Very recently, I say recently, maybe 2 years ago, NIST released some of the films that they had held. They had like 15,000 still photos and hundreds of videos. They released some of them, including the raw footage that the Nordays had shot. And when you look at it, what they've done is they've sort of doctored it up with sound. You really can't hear too much of the talking. They put irritating sound on there. It's very hard to pick it up. And the quality is not as great. And it says it's not for publication. But if you look at it, it shows that the firemen are standing around at this site where there's a supposed gas leak. If the supposed gas leak is going to be very dangerous underground, they're not stopping traffic. They're letting anybody walk by. And all of a sudden, they get onto their cell phones. They hear something, and then they spring into action and go look at in the street and point down their gas detectors to make believe. As you can see, they're almost play acting that they're trying to find out what the source of the gas leak is. Nobody's smelling any gas. They don't, as I said, stop traffic. All of a sudden, they look up. The cameraman who's filming this, because the probationary police officer is there, looks up, turns around, not just up, turns around. The plane goes behind the building and then reappears and goes into the North Tower. And he grabs the shot perfectly. So it's rather questionable. It's almost like they knew what was going to happen. They were there. They got there a little bit early. So, you know, what New York traffic is downtown and during rush hour. So they got there on time. They didn't block off any traffic. They're there. And then they spring into action and they continue filming down at the World Trade Center. Supposedly, the two brothers, one of them is missing down at the World Trade Center, so the other brother goes to look and try to find him. The only problem is that he continues past the North Tower and heads towards the South Tower, and lo and behold, he's in the right place at the right time to swing his camera up and get the second plane going in. Very, very questionable. This probably could not have happened by accident.
Too big of a coincidence. Right. So here we have these two guys, supposedly born in Paris, no record of that, went to NYU film school, no record of that. And you've been studying this and in connection with a Scottish researcher. Maybe you could tell us a bit about that.
Well, I've been, ever since the day one of September 11th, I've always been political and always questioned things that governments do, all governments, not just the United States government. And it was a long, arduous path. I mean, I originally thought that there were, you know, so-called hijackers. I thought that the government was incompetent. I didn't particularly like Bush at the time. So my first take on it was that this was total incompetence on part of the Bush administration. But as I got deeper and deeper into it, within 6 to 8 months, I began to realize that it was much more than that, that it was perhaps the incompetent story was something they'd rather have us believe than something more nefarious that might have happened. In other words, that they may have been involved in one way or another. To what degree, I didn't know at that point. After about 2 years, I guess that was in like 2003, I became aware of this Scottish researcher. It's not so much that he's not a researcher per se, but he's a son of a fireman in Glasgow, Scotland. And he's sort of a curmudgeon type guy. He's a little bit younger than me. He recently passed away, by the way. And he, using only the library at his local computer in this suburb of Glasgow, was able to ferret out all this information, which is publicly available, about the Nordegg brothers, about the fire department, various videos that were involved when what they were doing and who they hung out with, and began to piece together a story that, in fact, this was a setup. This was a setup by somebody that knew ahead of time what was going to happen, and they needed that first plane going in, the iconic shot. They knew everybody was going to get the second plane because that was going to happen 15, 20 minutes later, and TV and everyone would be on that, but they needed that first shot. And this was the setup for it, at least what he believed.
Are they the only ones who got that first shot?
There was one artistic gallery owner that had a camera set up in Brooklyn that was taking a photo of Manhattan at like every 10 seconds or so. And he happened to get not the plane going in, but before the plane in and went after. And there were a couple of guys that were going down into the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel that connects Lower Manhattan to Brooklyn. And as they were going down, they were filming. They just happened to have their cameras on and caught the first plane going in, or at least about to hit the building because they were coming from the south. But it's very poor quality because it's very far away. So they really were the only ones. And as I said, this is the iconic shot. None of those other images were useful in any way. So this man, Leslie Rayfield, pieced all this together, FOIA request. I contacted him and became involved in the effort, not to the great amount of time that he spent. I got him copyright for his site. I did some FOIA requests, etc., and became involved in offering suggestions on how the site could be better, etc., and how we should contact people and try to enlarge it. It never really went that far within the movement. I guess it sort of was a sidelight, but it is part of the pantheon of stuff within the 9-1-1 Truth movement the attempt to find it. And I think this is one part of it. The filmmakers are still alive. We know where some of them are. We know.
Tell us about them.
Well, one of them lives in Connecticut, down in Stamford area, married to a real estate broker. He's very quiet. He doesn't want to talk about it. His brother, Gideon, seems to jump around. He's not in any one place at any one time. And the father is still around, claiming to be a world-famous photographer, knowing other people, but he hasn't really published too much. He has a house in his legal address somewhere in California, and he has an address somewhere in the 70s. It's right on the bell there, but he doesn't want to talk about it either. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't necessarily mean that they were in on this in the sense of being, in other words, they could have been, had limited knowledge. They said, we want you to do something, and they may have followed it, and then they may have at some point realized that, hey, we were had also. I mean, but they also know that if they do anything, that their existence might be threatened.
Tell us a little bit about the significance of the name Nordegg, because we know that there's no evidence of them being born in Paris.
Well, they were assigned to the Duane Street Fire Department, which, interestingly enough, they had a whole bunch of people coming into that department. And like within 2 or 3 months after 9/11, a whole bunch of them had left. It was almost like they were packing the place with these people that may not, in fact, have been firemen. Interestingly, not one fireman perished in the conflagration that followed the planes hitting the buildings. They all survived. It's as if they knew something was going to happen, because virtually every other fire department, the personnel were lost from various other fire department installations. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the Nordegg, which their name precedes 9/11, but it's interesting, Duane Street is an anagram of Nordegg. So I'm not into numerology and stuff like that. It's just very curious. So
yeah, it is very curious. I think that's quite interesting.
I don't think it had anything to do with it, but it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. This film they made is called 9/11.
Yes.
And people can find that online, or is it?
I think it might be on YouTube. You certainly can purchase a copy at Amazon or whatever. And it's very interesting because within the film, which once they had the raw film, they had some really top people out in the film industry that helped them put stuff together. One of the producers was the editor of Vanity Fair magazine. They had Susan Zirinsky, who was a big producer at CBS. They all collaborated with them to put together an incredible film in terms of editing, cuts, etc., length, sound quality. But within the film, there, as I said, well, let me just back up. They had filmed the first plane going and then the second, but they also continued to film during the course of the day. And within the film, there are a number of interesting either mistakes or things that they had put in to alert us, maybe secret messages or something. I don't want to be too conspiratorial here, but it's interesting. We can go over some of those.
Yeah.
Because in one case, they filmed some of the firemen a day or two after 9/11, and they're standing around talking about the events of the day. And on the film, the firemen are standing there saying that they were watching what was going on, and they were inside the building, then they were outside the building, and they heard a series of boom, 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 before the buildings had started coming down, which would indicate the existence of explosives. Now, the various investigative bodies, such as NIST, say that there were no explosives there. But yet, that's in the film. Now, the question is, why is it in the film? Did they make a mistake to leave it in because they didn't know what the official story was going to be? That the fires brought down the buildings as opposed to explosives? Or are they sending us a message that, you know, we made this film, but, you know, here's something for you to think on. Yeah. Take a look at this. I have no idea. Who knows? Mm-hmm. But it's interesting. Another interesting thing is that the probationary police officer, Tony Benetatos, was sent back to the firehouse because all the firemen were down at the site and they needed somebody to answer the phone. And for some reason, obviously, he was not alone because somebody was filming him. And what you see is he's sitting by the phones and up above his head is a TV screen with a picture of the Pentagon with smoke coming out of the Pentagon. And he utters an expletive, you know, damn, the Pentagon has just been hit. We're at war. He says something to that effect. But interestingly, right next to the TV monitor is a clock, the official clock at the fire department. And the clock says 9:30. The story is that the Pentagon was hit at 9:37 in the morning. So what happened at 9:30 that they're seeing smoke and stuff coming out of the Pentagon? Now, this could have been filmed after the fact. It may have not been filmed that day. And they just screwed up because at that point they thought something hit at 9:30. That was the story at the beginning. Some other researchers have said that there were explosives actually that went off in the building at 9:30 prior to something that whatever hit the Pentagon, whether it was Flight 77 or it was some other plane that hit it, whatever. So that happened at 9:37. So again, did they screw up? They didn't know what was really going on? Or is this some sort of subtle message to us that this is a wink, wink, nudge, nudge type thing? So very interesting.
Yeah, that
to
is
watch.
Very
yeah.
interesting. Yeah. They did that very early on, so maybe they didn't know what the official story was going to be.
Precisely,
so
it was still being formulated, yeah. So maybe maybe they just screwed up with that or whatever. Yeah. But it's there, and it's interesting. So,
Frank, you've talked to us now about the background of these guys, the indications of foreknowledge, your research with the Scottish guy, and the mistakes in the film. Is there anything else about these guys? I know you went to their home, didn't you, looking to talk to them or ask them questions? Maybe you could tell us about that.
They will not talk about it. We've written them letters. We've made offers to them, discussed stuff that they don't bother answering, whatever. So for whatever reason, they want to maintain their silence. It could be because they know the truth or they don't want to be maybe subject to legal action, etc. So I can't answer that. But your listeners can actually go to the website that we've had put together. Mm. Currently being maintained by myself. Just type in frankresearch.info/Naudet911. That's a capital N, though. N-A-U-D-E-T 911. So it's frankresearch, one word, .info, I-N-F-O, slash, capital N, Naudet 911. And you can see it's a really extensive website, and there's a lot more than what we're just talking here in a half hour to cover it. The various arguments for and against this. There's actually cuts from the film, or still cuts from the film, showing some of the stuff I talked about, as well as some of the people involved with this. One other thing, very interesting, they had been authorized by the fire department to film the story of a probationary officer becoming a full officer, and they supposedly started in January, February. I filed a FOIA request with the fire department because you need a film permit to film in the streets of New York, and you also need a film permit to film anybody in any of the departments of the city, whether it's the training center on Randall's Island that's near the Triborough Bridge or in a fire department office or whatever. They complied with my request. The only problem is that the date that they gave them to do the official filming was dated like July 15th or July 20th. not January or February when they actually started it.
So what do you make of that?
Well, I think what they did is when I put the request in, they cobbled it together and they didn't realize what they were doing, that they didn't know when they had started filming, because probably the filming started in earnest probably around that time as opposed to much earlier. Uh-huh. And that's when they just put that in. They said, oh, we got to show that this is. And somebody maybe didn't understand the chronology of when they said that they had started. So again, it's another, not proof in and of itself, but another indication that
the story is flawed.
Somebody's not watching that. But you know what? They're counting on people that don't look at stuff like that. As long as people don't look into various stuff, ask questions, etc., they're home free.
Yeah, no, it's true. And really, it's only this Leslie Rayfield, the Scottish guy, and you who are doing any research on this. So you
tell people that. Again, it's part of a whole gestalt. It's not one thing is going to prove it, but you have a whole series of these things.
There's so many different anomalies like that.
If you see on the website, there's many more that I haven't even gotten into. I'm trying to think of some others that might be of interest to the listeners.
What's the next step in your research on this?
Well, as indicated, I was sort of like passive for the last year or two because the owner of the website, Les, was putting some stuff together. I was waiting for some new stuff to come out, but then he died rather suddenly. I'm not going to say this, no question. I spoke to the family. I don't think there's any question. He was sick for a while, and then he thought he was going into the hospital for some bursitis or something like that, but then he died in there. So the family didn't want any part of the website, but they turned over the rights to me. And I'm going to be updating the website with new material as I attempt to do some interviews with people and try to keep it more current. So there is on the website the ability to contact me if they have further information, if you want to get involved with it, or just ask questions or whatever. Mm-hmm. So it's going to go forward.
Okay, and that website again is Frank?
It's frankresearch.info/Naudet911. And the Naudet is Naudet, but a capital N. If you blew a lowercase N, you won't get there.
Okay. Great. And didn't I read somewhere that Leslie Rayfield, the Scottish guy who did a Freedom of Information request about gas leaks at that time on Duane Street?
Yes, Les put in a FOIA request, the Freedom of Information Act request, through the fire department and asked them for a copy of the actual order indicating that there was the gas leak. And he was told, we have the letter, that they will not release that kind of information.
Really?
It's public policy that they cannot release that kind of information, which seems rather ludicrous.
What would be the need to hide that information?
Right. I mean, if somebody is, anytime that there's some wild shooting going on, they often play the 911 tapes that people call into 911. They release it all over the place. Here, they wouldn't release that, which might further indicate that it was a phony call. No call had ever occurred. They just showed up there.
Couldn't release it because they didn't have it.
Curious is, just 3 months prior to that, 3 firemen had died in Queens at a gas explosion within a house. And the fire department personnel was still in mourning. And to go out to something called a gas leak and to be so blasé as you would see on the film, on the raw footage there, and not care about it, they knew that there was no gas leak there. That's a further indication of that. They would have been much more assiduous keeping people away, keeping personnel away, and they're just staying around, joking around, etc.
And again, they may have been told that it's just to stage this for the Naudet brothers taking the film or whatever. They may not have known.
As I had indicated, they had packed that particular fire department with like 15 to 20 extra personnel prior to this, and those guys had left within 2 or 3 months after. They didn't want to do it too quickly. So they, in fact, may not have been firemen. They were wearing the clothes. You know, it was dress-up time, playtime, and they really weren't firemen. Mm-hmm. So maybe they weren't that. And they knew that it wasn't a gas leak, but that was just the cover story.
Yeah. Well, this is fascinating research, Frank, and what you're doing is quite unique. Is there anything else you want to say to the listeners before we pause today?
Yes. The Naudet brothers Jules Naudet was quoted as saying, I guess he was being interviewed on Charlie Rose. He says, quote, "They say there is always a witness for history. I guess that day we were chosen to be the witness." Question is, who chose them?
Yes.
Was it God? Was it somebody a little bit more mundane like the Pentagon or something like that? Right, who knows?
Yeah. Well, that's a good way to end the show with one more unanswered question about 9/11. Well, thanks so much for being on the show, Frank.
You're welcome.
And again, that was an interview with 9/11 researcher and radio show host Frank Tolupko, presenting the research on what looks to be the hoax of the Naudet brothers' film called 9/11, and indeed the hoax of the Naudet brothers themselves. Just one more of the many anomalies and inconsistencies of the official account of 9/11. And now I'm going to share with you some 9/11 news and an upcoming event. First, the number of architects and engineers signing the petition demanding a new investigation into the collapse of the three World Trade Center towers, has reached 2,201. And the other supporters has reached 19,070. These numbers just keep growing as more and more people discover the evidence that has been compiled by the 9/11 Truth Movement over the last 12 years. If you, too, would like that investigation that we've never really had, you can go to the website ae911truth.org and join your fellow citizens in demanding the truth. There's power in numbers, so I really recommend that you do that. And the website is full of scientific information about the collapse of the three World Trade Center towers, lots of other articles and related information. So I encourage you to check it out. ae911truth.org. And we now have a candidate for the Connecticut Attorney General who says he'll investigate 9/11 if elected. He's Steve Fournier and is running on the Green Party ticket. And his top priorities are, one, to investigate the demolition of the World Trade Center. And he says, in the most brazen crime ever committed on September 11, 2001, agents of government allowed two Manhattan skyscrapers to be demolished with thousands of people trapped inside. The official explanation for the collapse of these buildings is supported by no competent evidence and mocks the laws of nature. No government official has ever been charged with responsibility for this atrocity, in which the people of the state of Connecticut suffered grievous injury. It is the obligation of our Attorney General to investigate the shocking events of that day and the cover-up that followed. And some of his other top priorities are to restrain unconstitutional authority, to subject state contracts to critical scrutiny, to expose and oust corrupt officials, and to advocate for the poor. And again, his name is Steve Fournier, running on the Green Party ticket. He's a semi-retired lawyer in Hartford. And now for the event. On Monday, June 23rd, there'll be a program called Israel-Palestine Towards Peace, Apartheid, or Warehousing. It's going to be at the Unitarian Meeting House, 50 Bloomfield Avenue in Hartford at 7 p.m. Dr. Jeff Halper, co-founder and director of the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions, will speak to us about this organization's home rebuilding and peace-building work in Israel and Palestine. The Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions was founded in 1997 and is a nonviolent direct action group with offices in Jerusalem, London, Norway, and New York City. Dr. Halper is an American-born anthropologist, author, lecturer, and political activist who has lived in Israel since 1973. In 2006, Dr. Halper was nominated for the Nobel Peace Prize to recognize the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition's work to liberate both the Palestinian and Israeli people from the yoke of structural violence and to build equality between their people by recognizing and celebrating their common humanity. In 2007, the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions received the Olive Branch Award from Jewish Voice for Peace. So again, that event is on Monday, June 23rd at 7 p.m. at the Unitarian Meeting House, 50 Bloomfield Avenue in Hartford. And now, just a reminder, 9/11 Wake Up Call is produced in the studios at WWUH 91.3 FM on the campus of the University of Hartford, and airs on Wednesdays at 12 noon and again at 8 p.m. and airs on WESU 88.1 FM on the campus of Wesleyan University on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. The earlier shows are archived on the great website ct911truth.org, and the more recent ones are at the website radioforall.net, and that's the digit 4 in radioforall.net. Once on the site, search for 9/11 Wake Up Call or look for my name, Cheryl with a C, under the Contributor column. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.